bridge in Durham, North Carolina. And it was built in 1940 so that trains can cross over South Gregson Street there in town. And in most ways, it's a normal bridge. It does its job, right? It transports trains just fine. But it is unique in one very special way. See, back in 1940, we didn't have the same sort of traffic that we have today. And particularly, we didn't have as many large trucks and buses. In 1973, the standard clearance for a bridge was set at a minimum height of 14 feet to allow vehicles to go safely under. But they didn't require bridges that were already built to be changed. And so, while today's standard is that bridges have to have at least 14 feet of clearance, this bridge, the one in Durham, North Carolina, is only 11 feet and 8 inches off the ground. And it's because of that, how low it is off the ground, that it has gotten the nickname the Can Opener Bridge. Let me show you what I mean. So now you know why it's called the Can Opener Bridge. I know that's kind of painful to watch. And maybe as you watch that, you're wondering, you know, how do so many people hit it? Don't they see the signs? You know, does anyone pay attention to the warning? I'm going to show you one more video where somebody clearly sees that there's a warning here. You see the truck there at the intersection. They're thinking about it, but they make the right call. Oh, man. They were so close, right? They were so close. I really had some hope for them. They just couldn't resist. You know, I wonder what it feels like to be the person in charge of that bridge. Like, you've got the signs up, you have flashing lights, and people just keep ramming into it, right? In 2019, they spent $500,000 raising the bridge by 8 inches. And another truck hit it 22 days later. And people continue to this day to document the crashes that happened there at the bridge. They're ongoing. There's been well over, I think, 200 at this point. So people aren't getting the hint. You know, our lives are kind of full of warning signs. You know, every time you buy something, every item you buy, it comes with a host of warnings to keep you from hurting yourself or someone else, right? And some of them get pretty ridiculous. I have some actual real-life warnings that come along with some new products you might buy that I'm going to share. So first, we have a stroller. Make sure to remove child before folding. A power drill is not for your teeth, right? Here's a jet ski. Don't use a lit match to check the fuel level. A dishwasher, not a playground for children. An iron. Listen, some of us are guilty of this one right here. I know. Some of us have tried to iron while wearing the shirt. Maybe just me, I don't know. A scooter, so that there's a helpful warning there that moves when you're using it. If you don't know how a fish hook works, and finally, here's a really important warning about thermometer usage, okay? So commit that one to memory. And here's the sad thing, right? Here's the sad thing is those warnings exist, Because those are things that people might do or have actually done. As we've seen, humans are pretty good at ignoring the warning signs. So, when warning signs fail, you're forced to go a step further, and you need a guardian, a protector, a defender, you know, something dangerous that can keep people away. So we have these in real life, right, with the bodyguards of Secret Service. There's soldiers that guard the tomb of the unknown soldier. And our stories are full of these guardians. I think of Aladdin. You have the giant sand tiger that guards the Cave of Wonders, you know, who disturbs my slumber. In Greek mythology, you have Cerberus guarding the entrance to the underworld. In Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, he has tests and traps and ancient knight guarding the treasure at the end. But when I think of guardians, my mind goes back to this movie that I watched growing up, The Neverending Story. Now, who's seen this movie? Can I get hands? I'm really curious. Okay. Okay, good. You know, the theme song, which is an incredible theme song, it got featured a few years ago in Stranger Things, I think, and that did bring some attention back to the movie, so maybe you're familiar with it through that if you haven't seen it. It is surprisingly intense for a children's movie, Neverending Story. And there are some pretty tragic scenes that stick in your mind. If you know, you know. And that may be why I have referenced this before, because those traumatic scenes are stuck in my brain from this movie. But there is an incredible guardian scene in The Neverending Story. See, Atreyu, the story is about this boy, Atreyu. He's a young warrior boy, and his world is being consumed by something called the Nothing. And so Atreyu, he has to journey to the Southern Oracle to find out how to stop the Nothing. It's all good, but to get to the Southern Oracle, he has to pass through its guardian, the Sphinx Gate. Now, the Sphinx Gate has these two large Sphinx statues guarding the path forward. When Atreyu gets there, he sees, off in the distance, a knight is preparing to pass through the gate. And it's explained to Atreyu, to pass through the gate, you must have confidence in your own worth. If you doubt yourself, the gates will destroy you. As he watches, the knight draws near to the Sphinx Gate. And as he begins to pass through, the eyes of the Sphinx statues open slowly. And then lasers like blast out it and disintegrate this knight, just vaporize him right there. So now it's Atreyu's turn. He has to pass through the Sphinx Gate. So he walks forward confident, and the Sphinx eyes remain closed. But at the halfway point, he looks down. He sees the armor of the dead knight lying there. And the helmet pops open, revealing nothing inside. It's been totally disintegrated. And you can see the fear and the doubt start to creep in on Atreyu's face. And everyone's cheering him on. They're yelling, "Confidence, Atreyu, have confidence!" But slowly, the eyes of the Sphinx begin to open. And so the cheers of confidence turn to cries of, "Run! Run, Atreyu!" He sprints forward. He jumps at the last second. The lasers fly out and barely miss him. He passes through the Sphinx Gate. And it's really this incredible scene that highlights the danger of trying to enter a place where you're not welcome. Now, there's a reason that the creators of Neverending Story called it the Sphinx Gate. Because obviously, you can tell the design is probably inspired by the Sphinx in Egypt, with the main difference being the wings, right? But the Sphinx is not an original design. In fact, the design of these statues, a creature with a human head and an animal body, it was widely known in the ancient Near East. Archaeologists have uncovered hundreds of depictions like these from the cultures surrounding Israel, Persia, Assyria, Babylon, Akkadia. They all had very similar features, you can tell. A human head, a body usually of an ox or a lion. Often they would have eagle's wings. And they were called cherubim. Cherubim. And they were not, you know, cute little toddlers with wings that you see on Valentine cards. No, the job of cherubim was to be guardians. Most often, they stood outside of sacred temple spaces, protecting the gods within from trespassers and the uninvited. They were a warning. There were large, monstrous statues flanking the entrance. There was no clearer way then to say, "Do not enter. You're not welcome here." Well, I want us to keep these guys, keep cherubim in mind this morning as we go forward, okay? You know, as Easter has approached, our children's ministry has been preparing something very special for us. Next Sunday, like we mentioned earlier, we're invited to show up at 9 a.m., share some time together with bagels and coffee, and then the children's ministry is going to share this book with us, The Garden, the Curtain, and the Cross. And this special time next Sunday, it is for everyone, and Barrett and I have even planned our sermons around this book. And so today, on Palm Sunday, we're looking at the garden and the curtain, the garden and the curtain. So let's turn to the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. You know, over the course of 6 days, God has created the world. The first 3 days, he's brought order to its environment. Day one, light and darkness. Day two, the skies and the seas. Day three, the land and the vegetation. And then on days 4, 5, and 6, he populates them all. You know, day four, the sun, moon, and stars govern light and darkness, day and night. Day five, the birds and fish fill the skies and the seas. And with day six, we get the land animals to fill the dry land. There's a beautiful poetry to it. Everything has a place. Everything has a purpose. And at the end of day six, there's one important addition. He creates humanity to rule over all of it, to be responsible stewards of God's creation. And importantly, humanity bears God's image. And within his new world, God created a garden, Eden, and it was a special place, right? A place where his new humans made in his image would live. Now, the book that we're using depicts the garden like this. And on day seven, God then rests from creating. He settles in to rule over and dwell with his creation. A life in the garden was wonderful. You know, over the break, over spring break, we got to spend a couple of nights at Great Wolf Lodge with our son. We had a blast, you know, bowling, putt-putt, water park, Magic Quest, you guys do it all. At the end of the second day there, our son looked at us and said, "Today was the most fun I've ever had." Now listen, Great Wolf Lodge is great, but it has nothing on the garden, okay? That was life in the garden, right? Every day was the best day you've ever had, and you always knew tomorrow would be even more amazing. The garden contained the tree of life, a never-ending source of life. Every need that humanity experienced was provided for in Eden. But best of all, God was there. We see in Genesis 3:8, God would walk through the garden. There's nothing better. There is nothing better than being with God. As the book that the children's ministry has selected for us says, it's wonderful to live with him. But the story doesn't stay in the garden. You know, humanity, the people God made to bear his image, to care for his world, to live in this beautiful place, they do a terrible thing. They disobey. They seek a world where God isn't king. They imagine what it would be like if they were like God, and they reach for it. And this, of course, is sin. This breaking of the good order that God had made, this disruption of harmony with him, disobedience, selfishness, it spoils and degrades, it perverts and destroys, and there's no place for it in Eden. In Genesis 3:22, God makes this remark about humanity in its sinful state. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. And this seems to be part of the reason for what comes next, humanity's banishment from Eden. I think it can be a confusing passage. I mean, what is God saying here? Is man now some kind of threat that has to be stopped from living forever? Maybe in a sense. Let me suggest what this passage could mean. Certainly, humanity is no threat to God, right? But remember what we said about sin. It corrupts and destroys, it spoils and harms. Already, right away in Genesis 3, we can see how it has broken what were once good relationships. The earth was made to produce and provide for humanity and all of creation. But now it is cursed, full of thorns. Only through grueling work will humanity be able to bring about enough food to survive. Humanity had been called to fill the earth with offspring, but now that sacred calling has been corrupted as well. For women, in particular, childbirth becomes painful and dangerous. Even marriage, this beautiful partnership between men and women that God created, has been corrupted. And we see how sin has brought competition and disunity to Adam and Eve's relationship. So no, in its sinful state, humanity isn't a threat to God, but humanity is a threat to creation. Their initial act of defiance is rippled out into all of creation, breaking and spoiling and corrupting it. And it's not just damaging to creation, it's also damaging to the ones who commit it. You know what it's like to be bitter, hardened, jaded, hateful. You've seen it lived out in another. You've felt the effects yourselves. Now spool that out into eternity. If you spend 100 years in the grip of sin, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, what sort of horrid creature would you become? So perhaps the reasoning of verse 22 is this, that God, in his mercy, he knows the terrible fate that awaits creatures corrupted by sin. He wants something better for us. He can't let us live like that forever. And even if that isn't the reasoning on display in verse 22, we do know that sinfulness cannot survive God's presence. We see in Exodus 19, God's presence descends onto a mountain, and the people are warned not to approach it lest they die. His holiness is like this nuclear reactor that in our sinfulness we cannot approach without the proper protection. So we read in Genesis 3:24 that he drove out the man. At the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. And there he is. There's our cherubim. There's some sort of angelic creatures guarding the eastern exit out of the Garden of Eden. You know, it's not so different a picture from how many other cultures at the time constructed their temples. The entrance is facing east toward the rising sun, a cherubim guarding it. But whereas, you know, in pagan temples, the cherubim were there to guard the gods within from outside trespassers or thieves, here the cherubim is for our protection, to keep us in our sinfulness from seeking our own destruction. The cherubim is this big flashing light and warning sign, danger, do not approach. It's a symbol that something has gone deeply wrong. Something once beautiful has been broken. As the book we're reading next week puts it, while it is wonderful to live with him, but because of your sin, you can't come in. And that's the story of the garden. Now, the story of the curtain will take place much later in history. It's the 10th century. God has chosen a people, the Israelites, to represent him, share who he is with the world. They have a new king, King Solomon. He's the son of David, a man who, though certainly very flawed, was also known as a man after God's own heart. David had a dream of building a temple for God in Jerusalem, and Solomon executes that dream. Now, we won't go into every detail of the design that goes into building the temple, but I do want us to see some striking similarities that the temple shares with our garden story. You can find the account of the temple being built in 1 Kings chapter 6. And one of the first things you might notice is the interior of the temple is decorated like a garden. We're told in verse 18 it's carved with gourds and flowers. Verse 29 describes carvings of palm trees and more flowers. There are pillars standing out front that have 200 bronze pomegranates on each one. In fact, as you read, you see that everything in the temple is covered in this garden-like iconography. Trees, flowers, fruit, everywhere. And inside the temple is a golden lampstand. It's called a menorah. If you go back to its original design in Exodus 25, it's clearly meant to represent a tree. Its candlesticks are called branches. It has flower-like cups and buds and blossoms on each branch. And here it is, the significant tree-like lampstand in the middle of this garden-decorated temple. You know, for the Israelites, the details of the temple, they pointed back to the place where it all began, where God had dwelled in harmony with humanity. And it makes sense for the temple to point back to Eden, because that's what the temple was supposed to be, the place on earth where God's presence dwelled among his people once again. Of course, it wasn't as good as it had been in the garden. See, if you walked into the temple through an entrance that faced east, just like Eden, you'd find yourself passing through more and more restrictive areas. You know, anyone could come to the outermost courts within only Israelites. Another section deeper, only priests can enter. And then finally, you would come to the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. Within, God's presence dwelled. It was holy. It was sacred. And sin was still a problem. Only the high priest could enter, and then only once a year. Exodus 28 gives this incredible description of how the high priest wore bells on his robe so he could be heard moving around within. According to Jewish tradition, a length of rope would be tied around the high priest's ankle so people could check to make sure he was still alive, not struck dead by God's holiness. And to separate the most holy place from the rest of the temple, there was a heavy curtain that hung. It hung separating that entrance from the rest of the temple. And you know what was on that curtain? 2 Chronicles 3:14. He made the curtain of blue, purple, and crimson yarn and fine linen with cherubim worked into it. The cherubim, the temple, over and over again. It points back to the Garden of Eden with its trees and flowers and fruit. And as you approach the center with God's presence, just feet away, there they are, the cherubim. Just like in Eden, the warning is still there. Keep out. It's not safe for you here. See, the story of the curtain is a reminder of the story of the garden, that things are broken. They're not as they should be. That it is wonderful to live with him, but because of your sin, you can't come in. Today is Palm Sunday. It's a day where many Christians recognize the week leading up to Jesus' death on Friday and his resurrection and triumph over death next Sunday on Easter. You know, today, millions of Christians are reading about how a week before his death, Jesus entered Jerusalem. Keith read for us in Mark 11, starting in verse 1, how Jesus entered Jerusalem on a donkey. People, you know, yelled out, praised him as he came in. And I want us to focus in on the final verse there. You know, this is an important moment in Mark's gospel. Jesus enters Jerusalem as a king. People receive him as the Messiah. They're expecting him to rescue them from Rome, unite the Jewish people into a powerful kingdom again. But a few days from now, they'll be screaming for his death. But there's something odd about verse 11. He goes into the temple. And when he had looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. I mean, does that strike you as a little odd, like a strange detail to include? Mark mentions Jesus walking into the temple. He looks around. He leaves. What's the point? When Jesus walked in the temple, he would have seen it. He would have seen the art meant to remind him of the garden story, right? But for Jesus, it wasn't just history. See, he had walked among the real trees and flowers of Eden. He had felt the cool evening breeze. He'd seen the real tree of life. He'd been there when Adam and Eve hid in their shame. He shared their sorrow over what was lost because of their sin. He ordered the cherubim to stand guard. When Jesus entered Jerusalem, everyone had different ideas of why he was there. Some people thought he was there to rescue the Jewish nation from Rome. Some of his followers thought they would be installed as rulers. The Jewish leaders were afraid he was going to bring Roman persecution down on their whole people. But Jesus rode into Jerusalem, and he goes straight to the temple, and there he would have seen that curtain covered in cherubim. Keep out. No entry. And regardless of what everyone else thought about why he was there, Jesus knew why he was there, to tear that curtain in half, to send the cherubim home, to put an end to sin, to extinguish death forever, and assume his place as king over all creation. It is wonderful to live with him. That's what he wants. That's what he wants for you. To be with you forever as we were always meant to be all the way back in the garden. I think that's what Jesus was doing there in the temple that first Palm Sunday, staring down the enemy, sin, and separation from God, remembering how wonderful it had been for humanity to dwell with God and looking forward to having that again. You know, this week people will prepare for Resurrection Sunday in all sorts of ways. People will wear pastels, they'll paint eggs, take pictures with rabbits. I'm going to eat a bunch of Cadbury cream eggs. We hope that you'll be here Friday, if you can, to join us for that special Good Friday service, and that you'll come early next Sunday to share in a special time together at 9 a.m. And then Barrett's going to share with us the final piece of this story, the garden, the curtain, and the cross, right? But as we think about temples and curtains and gardens, this morning I'd like to suggest one other way we can prepare for Easter Sunday this week. In the time of the Old Testament, when other cultures around Israel would dedicate a temple, they would often have a seven-day dedication ceremony. It's not unlike God's creation of the world. And at the end of the ceremony, they would place an image of the god within the temple. You know, it was an idol. It was a statue in the god's image. It's the same word even, image and idol, same word in Hebrew. And the job then of those priests, their worship of this false god, was to care for that image, to make sure nothing happened to it, to provide for its needs. Now, when God created the place where he would dwell with humanity, when he creates the world, he likewise inserts his image into it. But of course, his image is not some statue of clay or stone. What is it? It's us. It's each person. Made in God's image. He places his image there. And if the role, the job, the worship of God's people is to care for his image, then part of our worship as God's people is to love and care for the people around us made in his image. Just as the curtain and the garden remind us that we're made to live with him, they also remind us we're called to love and care for the people around us who are made in his image. So let me encourage us in that, that this week, doing that, loving the people around us in truth and with extravagant generosity is a wonderful way to prepare to celebrate his resurrection next Sunday. Let's stand together and let's worship him.
Lay your burden down, every care you carry, and come to the table of grace, for there is mercy. Come just as you are, we are all unworthy to enter. Song, offer him.
seated.
Good morning, everyone. We just wanted to give a quick update. Knowing next week is Easter Sunday, we wanted to give a quick update 2 weeks out from when the shepherd selection timeline really begins for all of us. We've had questions, has it already started? Does it start in the fall? So we wanted to give you all kind of a timeline going forward, and then I just wanted to mention a few details. So as you can see on April 27th, that'll be the Sunday that Barrett will actually speak to the shepherd selection process with a sermon. And that kind of will kick off the process. Then going forward on April 30th, in the Wednesday night classes, as well as small groups going forward, we're going to be giving out different directions on certain prayers and different times to just think about the process, meditate on the process, and think about that. And then really May 4th will begin the process of nominations. So as you can see on the timeline, that will be basically a two-week time period. It will encompass three Sundays in total. The only things I wanted to mention about that today, we will get into more details about that on April 27th. The only things I wanted to mention about that today, because I've had other questions asked already, if I think of somebody that I really want to nominate, can I go ahead on May 4th and nominate that person? You very well can. However, part of the process that we will discuss with you all is that every Southside member that you wish to nominate to be a shepherd, you need to be in contact with them. This cannot be a process that is both anonymous, and it can also not be a process where you think of somebody, nominate that person, and have never spoken to that person. What we are trying to get at here is that the person you believe should be nominated, that person wants to be a shepherd. There's a lot of things that are going on in people's lives. There's a lot of time commitments in their lives. If they don't feel like they can be a shepherd at this time, then they need to be expressing that to you. Now, at the same time, if they say, please, go ahead and nominate me, I want to be part of the process, then by all means, go ahead and do that. We just want it to be a two-way street. You talk to the person, they reflect what they wish, and then going forward, feel free to nominate them. And the only other thing I'll mention today is that also be on the lookout. We're going to do nominations in two forms at this time. We're going to do it both digitally and what I call the old school paper format. We really encourage you to do the digital. It makes our lives a lot easier. There's going to be a QR code that we send out. The QR code will be live in 2 weeks. All that information in the QR code gets sent back to us, and it gets digitally sorted and immediately is much easier for us to go through. If you wish to do the paper format, by all means, feel free if you're more comfortable with that. My dad does not like iPhones. He doesn't like electronic process. So if he were here in this congregation, I know what he would do. So whatever you feel most comfortable with, please do that. And then once again, we will be giving more information going forward, including a brochure and a timeline that's in even more detail. But we just wanted to put this out there as April 27th is 2 weeks away now. So you can be thinking and starting those discussions because like we said, it can't be truly anonymous. The person you're wishing to nominate, you need to have some sort of relationship in terms of speaking with them, getting their permission, and then feeling confident when you nominate that person that they are going to be able to serve with our congregation. So if you have any questions for the shepherds themselves, by all means, ask them. If you have anything for the committee or the selection process, find us, and we're happy to answer your questions. Thanks.
If I could have the Allens come on up, please. It's always a special day when we get to bring children before the Lord. I think it shows two things. It gives them the importance of us praying for them over their lives, but it also shows the dedication of the parents wanting them to be lifted up before the Lord. Both things are a beautiful thing. Today, I've got a little gift. I'll go ahead and hand it. We've got Darcy Elizabeth Allen and Cash Michael Allen. Darcy Elizabeth Allen was born on September 29th, 2018, and Cash Michael Allen was born on November 5th, 2021. Both were born in Lexington, Kentucky, to parents of Patrick and Katie Allen. Both children were joyfully welcomed by family and friends, including their grandparents, Barry and Teresa Blevins, and Jeff and Martha Allen. The children's names have family significance. Elizabeth and Michael have been passed down for multiple generations, and Cash was named for his
great-grandfather Jimmy Cash Welch. Patrick and Katie hope that Darcy and Cash will continue to shine the light of Jesus and singing his joyful songs. They hope both children will be blessed with good health and happiness. Patrick and Katie have chosen Joshua 1:9 as a life verse for Darcy and Cash. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Let's pray for them. Father in heaven, just like to thank you for this day and thank you for the Cash, the Allens, and Darcy and Cash and their parents, and just pray that you would watch over them. Pray that you would help us as a church family. Pray for them. Pray for both the children and the parents as they go through life and be supportive to them. And just help them throughout life, because we know that any of us that have had children know that it takes more, it takes a community to make this work. And we want to be their community, and we pray for them, and just pray that you would be with the rest of the family to keep them in mind as they grow. We'd also like to take just a moment to thank you for the wonderful service yesterday for Jaina. Just pray that you would continue to be with the Callahan, Herndon, and Landry families as they go through this process. And thank you for giving Randy and Kelly and Barrett such nice words to say to Bon yesterday that celebrated Jaina's life. Just pray that you would bless us all as this week goes on. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. Where'd your team go? Oh, I hope you got some good money for him. Did you get some good money? All right. I hear they keep going.